some stuff, and thanks first for the organizers for inviting me. And now for something completely different. For the spheric emission and gamma ray burst, that's a little bit related to what we heard yesterday. And it's not directly related to other talks that we heard, but I'll try to connect it somehow. You'll see. It basically summarizes works that I was doing in the past couple of years with many collaborators, the main one being Felix Wright from Stockholm. Others are Ralph Weyers, Peter Mazaros, Martin Rees, and Bing Zhang, who is here. And also, he discussed a little bit about that yesterday. That's the bottom lines for those of you who don't have patience for the next 20 minutes. What I'm trying to promote is the idea that there is evidence for a thermal emission component during the prompt phase of gamma ray burst. And that thereby we're providing consistent physical interpretation to what we're seeing. I mean, basically the problem is, we see something and we want to know what it is. And if this is true, that gives really, really interesting consequences, which has many consequences, including to this audience. Once it is not really possible to have any analysis of the prompt emission phase using tools that are not consider this thermal emission component, or tools that I used for many years in analyzing the afterglow emission in GRBs. And the more interesting, the other side of the equation is that you can use thermal emission to deduce very interesting physical phenomena and extract physical information about the outflow and the nature of the progenitor of gamma ray bursts, which is still a great mystery. In particular, Bing talked about yesterday, I may repeat some of it. We may be able to deduce that in some cases, the outflow is pointing flux dominated. So where does it come from? Why thermal emission? So I kind of split it into observations and theory. So again, from the observational point of view, let's start, Bing was kind of mentioning it from what we see and then try to deduce what we understand. So we see photons. And what we really want is to, what we require is some physical interpretation of where does these photons come from. And in gamma ray burst community, it's often the prompt emission spectrum is being fitted with what's called band function after the late David Band, which is basically a broken parallel. It provides very good fit to many bursts, but it does not provide any physical meaning. Apart from that, it makes good statistical fit. And in some cases, this is one of the latest ones, you see something which clearly is not really good, is not fit. One possible physical interpretation would be that what we're seeing is due to synchrotron emission, which works pretty much plus minus well for the afterglow emission phase. The problem is that it does not work from the prompt phase, and that was noted already by people from many years ago, or at least the last decade. Rob Preece coined the term synchrotron line of death to show that the low energy spectral slope simply is inconsistent with what the synchrotron theory provides. And it's been there all over since then, so it's at least a decade, which requires alternative ideas. And there are a few, like Michiel is here, who was working on jitter radiation. Another idea that Bing and myself were working on was the idea that it could be that the magnetic field decays on a length scale, which is shorter than what people have assumed so far. Again, there is no good theory for that, so we could just postulate what the decay lengths could be and such that it would fit the observations. However, I think that the most obvious thing was just under our nose, and that is the thermal emission. And why do we want thermal emission? So I assume you've seen that, but for those of you who haven't, generally speaking, the fireball model of gamma ray burst, there are two major episodes of energy exchange. The first one is where the gravitational energy is being converted to kinetic energy. That's where the jets are formed. And exactly the mechanism of how it is, the details of this mechanism are not yet known. So this is where the jet is formed. And the second major energy exchange is where the kinetic energy, the form of the kinetic energy of the jet, is being converted, dissipated, to observe what we're seeing as gamma rays. So dissipation. Both these episodes of energy conversion are not 100% efficient, naturally. Every time you have energy conversion, you have something going on there. The efficiency is less than 100%. And in particular, so the remains of the energy is being emitted in various ways. For example, in this early stage, you have emission of gravitational waves, light maybe, have emission of thermal neutrinos, and partly you may have emission of photons. The point I have is very easy. every photon that will be emitted deep enough in the outflow, at regions in which the optical depth is very high, and the optical depth here that people speak of is huge, is the order of 10 to the 15 or so, will inevitably thermalize. And so it will be advected with the outflow, and eventually it will get out of the outflow once it reaches the photosphere, which we roughly know where it is, about the order of 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 13 centimeters, depending on the properties of the outflow. And so indeed, actually, thermal emission, the idea was there all the time, from the really early days of the fireballs of the cosmological gamma ray bursts from Goodman and Paczynski in the 80s through the 90s and through the 2000s. Of course, the point here is that it is not sufficient to have only thermal emission, because we're seeing also something which is non-thermal. But it doesn't mean that the thermal is not there. It is should be there, you know, accompanying the non-thermal. And again, thermal is everything that would come from any dissipation process that occurs deep enough in the outflow, way below the photosphere, so that the photon would have enough time to thermalize. So the question is, can we see it? And again, I want to mention, we're seeing something. And whether it is thermal or not is a matter of interpretation. And the problem when we try to interpret it is we have basically two problems. One is that the spectrum also contains a non-thermal part. And so it's not only thermal part, but there's also non-thermal part. And also the thermal part by itself may vary over time, i.e. smeared. And so it may be difficult to recognize. Felix Rides, my collaborators, I think his main contribution back in 2004, 2005 was to notice this problem. And so instead of looking at the time integrated spectrum, as many people do, he looked at time resolved spectrum. So he cut the spectrum into short time bins, shortest that he could find, and then tried to make a fit of the time bin spectrum, which is typically of order of about half a second, because that's when you have enough spectral and temporal coverage to make any useful analysis. And he found that you could fit the spectrum pretty well with a model that contains this thermal component plus a single non-thermal power, just a single power law that models the non-thermal spectrum, which is reasonable over a limited energy band. Now, the interesting finding of his was that when he looked at the evolution of the temperature of the thermal component as a function of time, you can see that the time scale here is a few seconds, he could find something which looks interesting. He found that the temperature seems to decay in time as a broken power law. With a break at a few seconds, at first, let's say a few seconds, the temperature seems to be roughly constant or slowly decaying, and then it seems to decay in a more rapid way as t to the minus 2/3 roughly. But again, I think the most interesting part here is that this provides some consistent physical interpretation, at least to some parts of the spectrum, not to all of it. But that was done on a you know, sample of a few. And so last year, Felix and myself decided to do a little bit more systematic search for thermal emission component. And so we took a fairly large sample of bursts. Here are 56. And we looked for both the temperature and thermal flux and how they evolve in time. And the major findings are the following. First, we were able to identify thermal emission. This is good news. And the second thing is that we find that there is a characteristic behavior of both the temperature and flux, which seems to repeat itself over many different independent bursts. And these are part of the sample. So again, what you're seeing is the evolution of the temperature, which is, as a function of time, you can see clearly that first few seconds, it seems to be roughly constant or slightly decaying, and then it decays more steeply, about t to the minus 2/3 after the break, which seems to repeat itself. And at that time, you know, we were not surprised that when we look at the evolution of the thermal flux, we also found a characteristic behavior, some increase, and then a break time, which is within the errors of the break time found in the temperature, and then a decay that goes t to the minus 2 at late times. And again, that repeats itself over and over. And when you took the histogram of that, then you can clearly see that the histogram, although there is, of course, scatter, roughly the average is that the flux decays at late times t to the minus 2, and temperature is t to the minus 2/3, which seems to be ubiquitous, repeating itself over many bursts. And the last thing we did, which is already in view of what I'm going to say next, is to look at the ratio of the flux to the t to the 4. Of course, that is related directly to the emitting surface, to the size of the emitting surface. So if you take it to the power 1/2, this will be directly related to the emitting radius or to the radius of the photosphere, which is some physical radius, which you can say something. And again, we can find this ratio increases with time at about t to the power 1/2. So by itself, you know, I'm a mathematician. I did this work with Felix, but you know, it's kind of interesting. The fact that you're saying something that repeats itself all over in different bursts is interesting. So how can we understand that? So I already said that I'm not surprised at all to find that there is thermal emission over there. In a very, I would say, equivalent way to what you'd expect in the Big Bang. This should be there as the remains of the initial explosion. And in addition to that, you may expect an additional thermal component resulting from any dissipation process that occurs deep enough in the flow so that the photons that are produced, no matter how, have sufficient time to thermalize before they escape. But the major part, as I mentioned, is the first part of energy exchange from the, let's say, the explosion that produces the jet. But of course, the point here is that the photons, the thermal photons, will escape once they reach the photosphere. But what is the photosphere? And it turns out that this question is not that simple as it may sound from first hearing. You see, I draw here a cartoon which shows that a ball of relativistically expanding wind composed of electrons, which are the scatterers. And let's say that the observer sits somewhere over here, and there are two photons that are emitted at the same radii from the source, and they're propagating towards the observer. The definition of the photosphere, by definition, it would be the radii in which the optical depths to scattering from the emission radius to the observer would be exactly equal to unity, so we need to integrate over the light path of the photon. And just from this cartoon, it's obvious that this photon would see a different density gradient and hence less scattering than this photon as they propagate toward the observer, which is, again, over here. Other words, that says that the photospheric radius strongly depends on the line of sight to the observer. And when you do the calculation correctly, you find out that the photospheric radius is, for constant outflow parameters, then will be depending on some constant, which depends on the outflow parameters, times some formula, which is surprisingly simple. Theta is the angle to the line of sight, and beta is the velocity, the expansion velocity of the plasma, which for small angles and high Lorentz factors will give you something which is goes of 1 over gamma constant for angles which are smaller than 1 over gamma and then goes to theta square. So as a function of theta, if you draw the photospheric radius, it looks something like that. Kind of non-trivial surface in space. The interesting point here is that once you put that, then if you ask yourself, okay, let's know that that the opening angle of GRBJet is say the order of about 0.1 radian. Then you're asking yourself, what is the time difference between the late time arrival thermal photons to the early times? You find it to the order of tens of seconds. So that brings us to the right time scale. But that's actually only the beginning of the story, because the truth is that photons have some finite probability to be scattered every place in the space where there are electrons, which is basically every place in space. So as a function of theta, you can draw the last scattering positions of the thermal photons, and you can quantify that as a probability of the photons to be last scattered at angle theta and radius r. And when you do that, you're able to get an analytical expression of what would be the expected flux that you'd see. Under a delta, oh, you cannot see the topmost line, I'm sorry for that. Under the assumption of delta function approximation, which means that I'm assuming that I'm injecting a delta function of photons in the center of an expanding sphere, what will I see when I integrate as a function of time? I have to integrate over the probabilities of photons to be scattered at radii r angle theta times the assumption that the observed time is only a function of r and theta. And then you get something which is proportional to t to the minus 2. Basically, this is integrating over the entire space. And the next thing will be what will be the observed temperature. And again, you have to do basically a similar integral, only taking into consideration the Doppler factor and the comoving temperature, which by itself changes with radius. And I will not have time to get into that, but it's something which is kind of a cousin of classical adiabatic energy losses, although it's not exactly the classical adiabatic energy losses. But you can basically show that the comoving temperature of the electrons will decay as r to the minus 2/3 times beta electrons temperature, the electrons velocity. When you do that, you end up with that at later times, the observed temperature should decrease roughly as t to the minus 2/3. And as a result, this ratio should increase slowly with time. So are we seeing thermal emission? Well, the point is, you know, again, I'm just repeating it. We can interpret what we're seeing in various ways. And the reason why I think that we're seeing thermal emission is because of two things. One, we're seeing repetitive behavior of both the temperature and flux. And the second point is that the temporal evolution, the late time temporal evolution, seems to be in excellent agreement with what the theory predicts. Again, kind of luck that theory was ready before the observation, before the observational work analysis were completed. So it was kind of prediction, which turned out to be excellent. So we have consistent physical interpretation to that. But what we're seeing, of course, is a complex spectrum in which thermal component is only one part of it. I put this slide, this may not be that important in for this audience, but it is very interesting for the GRB community to try to analyze the GRB spectrum, because what I'm showing here is various spectra that were produced by myself and Lazarus and Reese a few years ago. Was not aiming to fit any particular spectrum, but to show what various spectra may be produced if you're assuming that during the dissipation phase you have significant thermal component. And the results is not really easy because you have kind of Beck reaction. Basically, what happens is thermal photons would serve as seed photons for quantization, thereby cooling the electrons, and therefore most of the electrons will be cooled, have quasi-Masurian distribution, and most of the emission will be from these cold electrons. And so you can get various spectrum, which depends on the parameters that you're assuming. So it's not simple to analyze that. The next point is the point that now if you go along this line of sight, to my opinion, that opens a whole new way of thinking of the prompt emission. And I'll just go over that briefly because Bing was already mentioning that. This GRB 08-09-16-3, which showed very high energy emission lasting over a few seconds. The point here was that we did not see any thermal emission. So you can say, oh, you're great, but you know, we don't see them. Truth is, in some, you know, the GRB phenomenology is amazing. You know, you have many different characteristics. Some you see, some you don't. So, you know, what can you say? In those ones that we don't, we're saying the following. Look, we're expecting to see it, but we don't see it. The fact that we're seeing that energetic photons implies that the emission radius of these energetic photons should be pretty high due to the compactness issue. The Lorentz factor should be higher, the radius should be high. So we don't know exactly where it comes from, so we just draw lines as a function of gamma, which we don't know what it is. Given that gamma, we know what should be the photospheric radius, which is lower. So we know that these photons do not come from the photosphere. So for a given model, the question is, where is the photosphere? And the fact that we don't see it simply implies that somewhere between this radius, where the photospheric radius is, let's say 10 to 14, 10 to 15, to the emission radius of these energetic photons, which is about 10 to the 16 to 10 to 17, there is extra source of energy, which we don't know where it comes from, but we assume that it must come from pointing flux dominated outflow. And we could calculate what it should be. And the reason we got was sigma of about 20. So we should have pointing flux dominated outflow by a factor of 20 inferred from this type of observations. Now, I knew I'm not going to have much time left, so I'm just going to skip into the summary. But one slide before. So what does it mean? You know, it's kind of, that's kind of a philosophical slide that I added yesterday because, you know, there was a GRB conference 2 weeks ago in Venice, and I was happy to find out that people got more and more confused when they look at the prompt emission. I'm saying, okay, it's not really clear what produces the prompt emission, and I may even say even a stronger word. it may not even require the existence of any internal shockwaves. In most cases, not all of them. That's in sharp contrast to the afterglow, because in the afterglow we're pretty certain that there is a shockwave. That also means that there is no need. The observations by themselves do not require any significant hadronic contribution. We can likely explain pretty well what we're seeing by this combination of thermal plus non-thermal leptonic combination. And the last thing is that the source and the value of the magnetic field are not directly determined, as people used to think a few years ago, by fitting the spectrum. It's not that clear. And that by itself has significant implications for the possibilities of acceleration of cosmic rays to ultra-high energies in the prompt phase of Jurgis. Again, I'm not saying much about afterglow emission phase, because that's a different game. So given that I'm out of time, what I want you to take out of this talk is that, again, there are evidence for thermal emission during the prompt phase in many Jurgis. I won't say all of them, but in many of them, yes. And this is based on two things, I mean, this conclusion. One is that we're seeing a repetitive behavior, and B, we see agreement between theory and observations. And that thereby we're providing consistent physical interpretation to at least some part of the observed spectrum. The second point is that if you trust that, it means that it's not really possible to analyze the prompt phase properly using the same tools that people are using to analyze the afterglow, which is much simpler due to the much lower optical depth. And the last thing is that thermal emission can be used to extract physical information about the outflow of the progenitor. Some parts I did not show was how we can use that to actually measure directly the Lorentz factor and the, of course, the photospheric radius and the radius of the base of the flow. That's the part I skipped. And the second part, which I did not, and again, Bing also mentioned that, was that the non-detection of thermal emission could actually be used as evidence for non-baryonic composition, at least in a few Jurgis. Thank you very much.
Does the last point mean that there is baryonic emission in the ones where you do see thermal emission?
Excuse me again?
Does the last point mean that you have to have baryons when you do see thermal emission?
If you have to have baryons, I wouldn't say that you have to have baryons. I mean, the question is, I would tell you, I mean, I mentioned it in the slide before that. I think that the current interpretation of thermal of the prompt emission does not require to have significant, say, hadronic contribution. You do require to have some kind of, let's say, leptonic contribution, because you are seeing some parts which are obviously non-thermal. But it does not mean that you have to have, like, there are some models by Chuck Dermer that says that you have to have, let's say, significant acceleration of protons to high energies in order to produce these GeV emissions. I'm saying no, the data does not require that. So I mean, it's not there. It does not require that.
It seems like in different GRBs, this thermal or this peak of the emission seems to be in roughly the same energy band. It's always roughly half an MeV or about an MeV. What sets that energy scale, and why is it the same?
That's a pretty good question. If you trust the what I'm saying about thermal emission, then it's fairly easy, because this energy scale, you would basically identify it with the peak of the temperature. And the temperature by itself depends pretty weakly on the total luminosity and the initial radius of the flow. No, because not everyone are necessarily thermal. And that's where things become more complicated. And Bing was mentioning it yesterday, that thermal emission is necessarily more efficient than the non-thermal part. Because, again, according to the classical fireball, which I now tend to, I'm pretty sure that there are severe problems in there. According to the classical one, you have the flow is driven first by the thermal. The acceleration is being done because of the pressure of the thermal photons until it saturates, and then certain point dissipates. And thereby, you are losing some part of energy in that sense. So the thermal component should be more pronounced than the non-thermal one. So in terms of energetics, again, it's not very clear why to get the non-thermal peak close to the MeV. There is no, like, simple way of understanding that.
You seem to have this theory that explains why temperature decreases as T to the minus 2/3, but apparently only at later times, not at early times.
Yeah.
And also why the luminosity goes T to the minus 2. Now, I also have a theory for those facts. I don't think they're the same, but I was just wondering what the difference was as described by you.
The difference between my theory and
mine, yeah.
Well, maybe we should discuss this later.
Okay.
Hi. Just going back to the sort of origin of the fireball model, do you have any thoughts on how the enormous entropy per baryon in photons could actually be produced in the first place in an environment where the characteristic entropy of baryon is much, much less?
No. That'll be the fully honest answer. No, I don't know that. That's a deep question that I need to think about more.
The rejoinder is why, I'm sure there's a more attractive way of saying this, but I won't. Why has it attracted so much attention when there was so relatively little connection with mechanisms? I mean, there are one or two people who have talked about neutrinos and so on, but I think they've not in practice worked. But
Again, can you repeat the question?
Why has there been an assumption so often that there is that it's a radiation-dominated fireball that you're dealing with here?
Easier to deliver than to deal with, I think, as compared with magnetic dominated flow.
My impression in that would be simply that this is something that people are easier to understand than how the magnetic acceleration is. But that's, you know, that's the only thing I can say. My true impression, I started to look a little bit more about this magnetic outflow models. And my impression was that people put too many things there by hand. And so I think that simply because these models are not well understood, then it was easier for people to go into something that is, at least you can roughly understand the basic ingredients.
Okay, no further deep questions. Then can I draw your attention to this note on the board here about shuttles, and we'll break for lunch. Thank you very much. Well, I'm actually...